Hi there, it's Lee Mottishead here. As senior writer with The Racing Post, I'm often given assignments that involve doing justice in prose to the great spectacles offered annually by the sport of kings. I'm regularly challenged to react to what I see and hear, to explore the emotions that make racing so much more than a procession of fleet-footed, finely tuned avatars of our own athletic ambition. But for our new Blue Chip Premium series, The Story of Horse Racing in 20 Races, I was presented with a new challenge. Summon the ghosts of our sport's glorious past and glean from them the true and fascinating origins of what is, for many, the greatest race in the world. The following is an excerpt of that story. To read it and others from the series, you'll need to head to our website, racingpost.com. By the time the clock struck two, a crowd of maybe 30,000 people had assembled at what was, and still is, Aintree Racecourse. On a beautiful spring afternoon, they were waiting to see something the likes of which had never before been witnessed. It was the last day of February, 189 years ago, and a huge chapter in the history of horse racing was about to be written. Across the Atlantic, the Battle of the Alamo had entered its seventh day. In London, an aspiring author was awaiting the imminent publication of his debut novel's opening two chapters. The Pickwick Papers and the classic works that followed were set to make Charles Dickens an integral part of British culture. Destined for the same high honour was the most innovative form of entertainment about to take place just to the east of Liverpool. Contrary to what you'll have seen and heard elsewhere, the Grand National was not born in 1839. Rather, what was to become the world's greatest steeplechase had its first running in front of packed enclosures 3 years earlier than that, in 1836. Whatever they might tell you in future pub quizzes, the answer to that frequently asked question, and you know the one, is not lottery, but the Duke. Yet the first Grand National, staged initially as the Liverpool Grand Steeplechase, was significant not just for launching a sporting phenomenon. In a much wider sense, it changed the entire sport of jump racing. Earlier in 1836, there'd been an announcement in the local press linked to a Mr. William Lynn, a hotelier and caterer who for 7 years had been holding race meetings at Aintree on land rented from the second Earl of Sefton. Lynn, whose long and lavish dinners were centred around his speciality, turtle soup, intended to stage a grand steeplechase that would rival what was then the most celebrated event of its kind, the St. Albans Chase. Where they would differ, and where Lynn's invention would immediately become unique, is that runners would not go from point to point. In compiling this story, I spoke to John Pinfold, an acclaimed historian and pretty much the expert on the Grand National. Pinfold explained that up until this point, steeplechases started at one point and ended somewhere else. It was therefore extremely difficult for a spectator to watch the entire race. This new race was very different. Not only did it start and finish in the same place, Pinfold points out it was the first staged alongside proper infrastructure, such as grandstands, dining rooms and bars. Lynn was therefore able to attract a much larger crowd and make it a much bigger spectacle. It also deserved and delivered coverage in newspapers, many of which ran slightly abridged versions of the report penned by a local writer in the Liverpool Courier on Wednesday, March the 2nd. Readers were told,
"On Monday last, the first steeplechase ever run in the neighbourhood of Liverpool came off in the enclosed grounds near the Aintree Racecourse."
Turning to the novelty of a steeplechase being visible in its entirety, including by the elegantly dressed females who occupied most of the grandstand's lower parts, the article then stated,
"The country chosen for the race, which was not to exceed 5 miles in distance, was so appropriately chosen that it formed a complete amphitheatre in front of the grandstand, every spectator having the advantage of viewing the whole with the naked eye.
Even those without a telescope had no trouble seeing the 10 runners assemble at the start, for it was positioned right in front of them in almost exactly the same place where Nick Rockett and his 33 rivals began galloping on the 5th of April this year. How, though, would the 1836 test have differed from what we see in a modern Grand National? John Pinfold explained.
You would not see the fences as they are now, for sure. What you would see is the actual course is the same.
Where it certainly differed is that much of the race took place across fields farmed by tenants who rented land from Sefton. The hedges that formed the field boundaries were used as fences, but there was still a brook that 3 years later took on Beach's name when he fell in it, and there was still a turn to avoid entry into the Leeds and Liverpool Canal. What has changed completely is the Melling Road, which in 1836 formed the unofficial first fence. By the time the pioneering 10 horses were sent on their way, the big race betting centred around 2-1 favourite Laurie Todd and Beach's mount, the 3-1 second choice, the Duke. Both were still in contention on the completion of the first circuit, at which point the Duke was sent into the lead. Soon after that, he was joined by Laurie Todd, whose prospects were ended at the tabletop, where his rider, a Mr. Powell, was suddenly thrown in consequence of the impediment of a gate being suddenly and accidentally closed. Lynn subsequently discovered the gate had been closed by the brother of the owner of one of the runners. Given the actions of Bretherton, Pinfold's summation is that Cocker Hoop's owner, a Mr. Thomas, may have been behind the foul play. By the time the remaining runners reached the final jump, a hurdle that would have been sighted on what is now the home straight of the hurdles track, a duel had developed between the Duke and Polyanthus, with the former ultimately prevailing by a length. 12 months later, the Duke claimed his second success in the prize for his owner and Mr. Surderfield, a Liverpool-based innkeeper. He then finished third in 1838, thereby establishing himself as a true Grand National legend. Why then has history, and indeed also most of those connected to Aintree, largely written the Duke and those first three Grand Nationals out of the story? To discover the answer and learn more from the National's historical custodian, John Pinfold, head to racingpost.com. If you aren't a Racing Post Plus Ultimate subscriber, I have got great news for you. Use the code MOTTISHEAD20 and you'll receive an enormous 60% discount on your first month. That's MOTTERSHEAD20. And while you're here, please subscribe to and like this podcast. It will ensure you never miss an episode of the Racing Post outstanding audio coverage, and it helps us to be discovered by new fans. Until next time, I'm Lee Mottershead. Goodbye for now.